Production made possible in part by MedPlus Advantage.
You're listening to Radio Rounds, a talk show created and hosted by medical students, where today's stories are told by tomorrow's doctors. On today's show, Dr. Edward O'Neill shares his story of developing a new model for medical service trips through his organization, OmniMed. Typically, groups of American healthcare volunteers use these trips to travel abroad and provide needed care in impoverished communities. Dr. O'Neill has been able to remove many of the time and geographic constraints typically characteristic of these trips and create a sustained, measurable impact through his village health teams, or VHTs as he calls them, in some of the world's poorest communities, even after his volunteers are long gone.
I've long felt that the engine of transformation is the poor themselves. We go over, we have profound experiences, in part because the diseases we see are fascinating, the places are fascinating, but the real key ingredient is the poor. They're amazing people, and they never cease to impress me with their dignity, their grace, the way they carry themselves, despite incredible hardship and poverty. Yet, our service does not always do the best things for them.
More from Dr. Edward O'Neill, founder and president of OmniMed, on Radio Rounds right now.
Welcome to Radio Rounds.
Welcome to Radio Rounds, everyone. I'm John Corker.
And I'm Ryan Shapiro. We're glad you could all join us today for our first episode of 2012. Whether you're listening on the web, on the radio, or via our iTunes podcast sometime in the future.
Yes, welcome back, everyone. After a really well-deserved winter break, we took a few months off here. It's just great to be back here in the studio and kick off our seventh season now on Radio Rounds. It's crazy to think that we've been doing this for seven seasons. Now, for most of our regular listeners out there, you may not have recognized Ryan's name. Ryan is our co-host and for the first time today in studio. And we, as much as we want to welcome all of you back to season seven, we want to give a big warm welcome to Ryan, to our Radio Rounds team. Ryan, glad to have you here.
Thank you very much, John.
Our guest today is Dr. Edward O'Neill. Dr. O'Neill is the founder and president of OmniMed. With its work based in Uganda and partnered with the U.S. Peace Corps, OmniMed works to send U.S. medical students, nurses, physicians, and others to train community health workers in their native countries.
Starting OmniMed in 1998, and eventually working in conjunction with the Brookings Institute, a world-renowned nonprofit think tank based in Washington, D.C., Dr. O'Neill has been able to create a new model for the medical service trip abroad that seeks to deliver a measurable and sustained impact. Based on the premise of feeding a man for a lifetime by teaching him to fish, rather than feeding him for a day by giving him a fish, OmniMed volunteers facilitate structured training programs for community health workers in Uganda and other impoverished communities worldwide. Dr. O'Neill recently took the time to speak with John and Radio Round's Washington, D.C. correspondent, Kabir Gulati, about how OmniMed got started, its methodology, and how it has been effective.
I started this in 1998, and we've had programs in several countries, mostly sending physicians overseas to do training. And we've run programs in Belize and Kenya, Guyana, and Thailand. And then as a result of the book that I wrote with the AMA, Awakening Hippocrates, I got involved in a group from Brookings that was looking to increase the number of people serving overseas. And if you look at the service space broadly, what you find is there are thousands of programs out there, and a lot of them doing really good work. But if you turn around and ask the question and say, well, I know it's having a really important and powerful impact, a transformative impact on those who serve, those who volunteer, what are we actually doing on the ground? Show me the evidence that says that volunteerism and service makes a measurable impact. And the data is lacking. There are some anecdotal studies, a lot of case reports, a lot of journal entries. And if you look at the medical literature, you'll see a ton of literature that looks at the impact on the volunteers. We know how it changes people's lives that volunteer. We know it affects their career choices. We know it affects their likelihood of serving in the United States. And a landmark report that just came out from Peace Corps says the same thing. About 93% would support the program and recommend it to others. And So there's no question that service works on the volunteer, but what does it do to those that we are allegedly serving? Now, as a fourth-year medical student working in Tanzania in the past, I had the sense that I was actually helping. I was helping the physicians, I was taking care of patients, and I know medical students go overseas and do some wonderful things. But when you get to the question of what the data is, that's where there's an enormous gap in the literature. And from a policy standpoint, when you start talking to people in Washington, D.C., and talking to legislators about wanting to get more federal funds behind a service movement to get more people engaged, which is, I think, critically important, the question always comes down to this: how do you know it works? So I was asked to chair a task force at Brookings, and our charge was to build a program somewhere in sub-Saharan Africa that would make a measurable impact using health volunteers. And what we did at OmniMed was partner with the Ugandan Ministry of Health to train community health workers. And the way we do this is to take a Ugandan program, and we work as facilitators primarily. Our volunteers don't run the program. We facilitate it. We have Ugandan trainers that do about 80% of the lecturing and training. Our volunteers go over and do, during the week-long trainings, we do maybe one or two lectures per day out of many, and then interject points to augment what's being said. We do home visits. We do quarterly meetings where we pull together groups of these community health workers called VHTs, or village health teams in Uganda. And during the process, we've trained about 700 of these VHTs using about 40 U.S. health volunteers. And we're conducting a randomized prospective clinical trial to measure the impact. And that's what's somewhat unique about our program. I can ask the question, does this work, and look at a lot of anecdotal evidence that says yes. We had a Harvard grad student do a study last year that found that bednet user rates, hand-washing rates following use of a latrine, dishwasher drying racks all went up by 110, 114%. So we know there is some preliminary data that shows impact. But what we're doing is we randomize villages within two parishes of the Makono district, Sai and Terere. And those two parishes, we chose impact villages and control villages. We measured health behaviors in all of them and then implemented the program in the impact villages only. After doing the program for roughly a year, we're going to collect the health behavioral data again. We're looking at 15 different parameters, like use of bed nets, hand washing, use of oral rehydration solution, vaccines, breastfeeding, early treatment for malaria, early treatment for pneumonia, et cetera, all basic things. And then we're going to look at how the health behaviors have and have not changed. And then using large trials that you can plug into a spreadsheet, you can then take a percentage of the number of people whose behaviors have changed and then figure out from that how many lives the program would save in such and such a size community over X period of time. So we're going to be able to estimate, based on this trial, how many lives this program saved, what the cost per life saved is, and what it would be to project this over a larger area. Now, it could be that we find that it's minimal impact. All the indicators so far are that we're going to find, I think, a significant impact. And it's, I think, an important piece in the service space where I think there needs to be much, much more looking at the impact. What are we actually doing when we serve? We're transforming ourselves, but are we really making a measurable life-saving impact on those we allegedly serve? And that's the fundamental question that we're dealing with.
Based off your results, though, do you plan on expanding the training modules, or could you tell me a little bit about how those training modules, how do your volunteers, how are they involved with the training sessions, and do you plan on expanding what training modules you currently give?
What we're planning on doing now is we have a very set template. Again, the literature lends a lot of credence to the idea that if you do service overseas, volunteers actually take up a lot of time and resources. And the way that volunteers are effective is by having a very specific role, preferably in a recurrent manner. So you go to the same place, you do the same thing. And that's what we do in our trainings. A typical month for a medical student that volunteers in our program, they go over the first week, they do some home visits out in the rural areas, which is fascinating. And then we do a week-long training, which is a fairly intense time, often 7 a.m. until 6 at night or so, during which it's training all day. And that we do by camping out in different areas. So we have tents, we have the, you know, we camp out and we cook, and you camp under the stars. It's actually beautiful. And after the training session, then we come back and we do follow-up and we do quarterly meetings and focus groups, as well as do work on the trial. And quarterly meetings, we pull a bunch of VHTs together, review topics during focus groups. That's a month after their trainings, and we hear how things are going. So there's a lot of feedback. There's a lot of maintenance. There's a lot of work that goes in the program. People are fairly busy while there, but I think it's a very enriching experience. And in terms of expansion, the model is set, and we've evolved the model over a couple of years to get it to where it is now. It really works beautifully. The next expansion is really dependent upon our partnership with the U.S. Peace Corps. We've had Peace Corps volunteers that have helped to coordinate the program with local Ugandans that we've trained and hired. And we've been discussing with Peace Corps where we're going to go next, which is probably going to be either in Jinja, which is just east of where we are in Mukono, or to the southwest, a couple of sites that we've discussed. So expansion is going to be per Peace Corps. And just another larger political question, this VHT model is a really interesting way to approach rural health. Less than half of Ugandan's population can actually access local health facilities rapidly, and that's one of the reasons for the VHT program, to get community health workers out in the field with some level of training that can refer, that can do preventive medicine, and then track health statistics. That's their primary roles. And with this program, the Ministry of Health in Uganda, with support from World Bank and the Global Fund and the Gates Foundation, has developed training modules to get these VHTs the ability to actually treat malaria and pneumonia and diarrheal illness. So we've incorporated that into our trainings, and we're in discussions on a regular basis with the ministry and with other people in Uganda as far as how this model works versus other similar attempts around the country. And from my surveys of places elsewhere in the country and a lot of meetings with local district health educators and district health officers, I can say that nobody has data like we do, because I think people are not great at collecting data generally. And I know that a lot of places have come in and done some trainings, but none done the maintenance. And we probably spend two-thirds of our time on maintenance of the VHCs that we train, and the other third, if not less, doing training of new people.
And Dr. O'Neill, John Corker here. You mentioned following up with the village health teams, and in terms of the study design that you speak of, following up that year after the groups have started certain treatment regimens and the VHTs have started to kind of practice what you've trained them to do. But after that year checkup, how do you stay in contact, or as you said, maintain those VHTs? How do you go about maintaining that relationship with the VHTs, and then also throughout that process, even within that first year, how do you measure compliance of patients with the treatments and lifestyle changes that you're working with them on in terms of accurately assessing the results?
Yeah, that's a great question, John. A two-parter. The maintenance piece is what we learned over the first 2 years because nobody was really doing maintenance. This program was started in 2003 in Uganda. And they actually had some good data from the Mpiji district where they showed that neonatal attendance rates were up. Women coming in for antenatal appointments were up. Malaria incidence was dropping. Anemia levels were falling. And that was on the base of this VHT program. That's the only data that the country had in this realm. And what's happened since then is the ministry has had some money to fund training. And what's often happened is VHTs will be trained, the money runs out, and VHTs are basically left high and dry. When there's a vaccination program, when there's a bed net distribution program, they are summoned. But if you train somebody and then don't have them do anything for a while, their interest quickly falls off. These are very poor people, incredibly smart, incredibly passionate and dedicated. And these are elected by their peers. So this is not it's not one of nepotism or being chosen because you're a friend of the village chief. This is a local elections where people elect the most capable folks. And, you know, these are passionate, dedicated people. And if you train them, if you give them the opportunity to provide a valuable service, they grab it and they really use it. But it's on us as an organization that's facilitating this to keep them. And so what we've evolved is a system where we train someone. Say we do a training on the first week of January. What we do then is, after that week-long training, 1 month later, we hold a focus group. During the focus group, we pull them all back and we ask them, how's it going? What can we clarify for training? And those sessions have gone very well. Then we do home visits. And with the home visits, we send out our volunteers and we have what we call the prompt, which has 15 different areas in it of the most life-saving skills written in Luganda language, the local language, with pictures. And then all the VHTs go door-to-door, and they hand them out to everyone in their village. And we've mass distributed these so far in the trial areas and beyond. And that gives the VHTs a sense of ownership as well as giving the local people buy-in. And it's amazing to see what they do with this knowledge. It's really encouraging, and that's what we're measuring. Following that, we do quarterly meetings where four times a year we bring all the VHTs together. We go over their record-keeping books, and then we cover a new clinical topic as well as reviewing older ones. We provide snacks. We provide some transportation funds, and that's how we maintain them. We also started a few other programs. There's one that's very exciting. We just had a dedication last Monday where we try and find the VHTs are the most motivated that are doing a great job in the country, in the areas where we've trained, rather, and we put in a protected water source. All the villagers have to contribute materials to it. Everybody helps out in the construction, and we funded the construction, and our staff has helped in the building of it. But by building a protected water source to the most highly performing VHTs, making it very public with village chiefs there and a lot of attention, all showered and all focused on the VHTs, we've added that as an incentive, just to give VHTs recognition and to let them know that they're appreciated. Now, how do we maintain, how do we know that this works and how do we monitor it? Well, the way that we're doing it is by doing this trial. And the trial measures the behavioral change and before and after, as well as the intervention area compared to the control areas. So given that, we're going to know if it works. And once we do the trial, we have the data, we have the results. Usually when you do a trial like this, often you'll end up doing a follow-up, and we'll probably end up incorporating some of these measures on a regular basis. And whether or not we do spot checks in time or we do a much larger trial, we're actually getting morbidity, mortality over time. That would probably be the next step. And there's, of course, anecdotal ways. We ask people just walking around a village before and then after a training. You can observe the number of latrines, you can observe the number of dish drying racks, and you can see the number of ITNs in the home just by walking around. And the VHTs will give you a very clear sense of whether or not people are adapting or not. And in these focus group meetings, one of the things we always do is we ask them, what are people doing? And it's amazing the power of shame when the VHT goes door to door and they talk about these things. And they say, the neighbors say, oh, so-and-so doesn't have a latrine over here, and the flies are always around. It is not really that long until when people have this knowledge, they start to talk to the neighbor, and there's a latrine that gets built. So there's direct, and then there's more anecdotal ways, but there are certainly a lot of ways where you can monitor the impact. But again, the gold standard is the randomized controls trial, and that's what we're doing now.
Dr. O'Neill, this is Kabir again. And you had spoken earlier about volunteers, and I was wondering, what advice can you offer to our medical and pre-medical student listeners out there as they continue to work their way through their training? And then also, how can pre-med and med students get involved with OmniMed?
Well, usually what happens is when people are interested, they just send me an email. We start a phone conversation, I look at the CV, and we discuss whether it's a right fit. And then if it's a good fit, then we set up a time for when they can go. And there's plenty of openings. When you look at this year, we have a few people committed in February, October, November, and in the spring, but we have plenty of openings. We have capacity for four at a time, and summers usually fill up quickly, but other months of the year is usually fairly open, so we have a lot of spots. And particularly as we expand to a second site, there'll be even more capacity if we get to Masaka. In terms of the first question, that's a more loaded one, and one that I've long held the belief that it's critically important that we engage. If you look at the number of doctors who go overseas, it's very, very small. It's about 1 in 300. And the only data we have is from a paper by Timothy Baker in JAMA in 1984. In fact, we're starting a new trial now to look at the number of doctors that go overseas. But we don't have enough of our profession engaged in this work. And that's the first piece. We need to get a lot more people in. Medical students now are going in record numbers. When I was a student in 1987, only about 6% of medical students went overseas. The last issue that I saw in the American Association of American Medical Colleges, the survey they do, found about 26% of students were going overseas. So a lot more people go, which is great. But I would urge people not just to go, but to go in ways that you're going to be contributing something, if at all possible. I've long felt that the engine of transformation is the poor themselves. We go over, we have profound experiences, in part because the diseases we see are fascinating, the places are fascinating, but the real key ingredient is the poor. They're wonderful people, they're amazing people, and they never cease to impress me with their dignity, their grace, the way they carry themselves, despite incredible hardship and poverty. Yet, our service does not always do the best things for them. But I do think it's important to engage. I think if at all possible, people want to stay in the realm, because as you go through training, medical school is hard, and residency takes a lot out of people. And what was once a powerful experience through the years of training and the hours required can become something I once did. And I think as important as Paul Farmer and Tom Dooley and Albert Schweitzer and many of the icons of our profession are, I think that we can gain so much more by having a larger slice of our profession engage on a regular basis in ways that are thoughtful, that are cooperative with the poor, that make measurable impacts.
Well, and those results and that measurable impact that you talk about, Dr. O'Neill, is certainly one thing that I think can and will encourage more smart people like physicians and physicians in training to want to get involved. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Radio Rounds today. We really appreciate you being on the show.
Great, John, Kabir, I appreciate your time, and I wish you both luck as you proceed on, and thanks again for having me.
You're listening to Radio Rounds, and I'm John Corker. We've been speaking with Dr. Ed O'Neill, founder and president of OmniMed. Now, Ryan, although Kabir couldn't be here in the studio with us today, he wanted to add a little something to the episode and just a reflection of his about an experience he had with poverty-stricken areas in developing countries. And just as a reminder, Kabir is our D.C. correspondent and guest interviewer with Dr. O'Neill today. And years ago, he was visiting India with his father. They were traveling by taxi across Mumbai, and while they were stopped at a traffic light, a young girl held a naked baby up to the glass window of their car, and she was asking for money. Now, Kabir just remembers this as being a very distressing event for his father, who had been a physician for over 25 years, and that the situation really affected him for years to come. And even years after leaving India for the United States, he noticed how powerfully reminded his father was of the lack of healthcare infrastructure in his native country. And it's just a similar story to what we're dealing with in the communities in which OmniMed works. And Ryan, I have had many friends who have returned from their medical service trips abroad with a sense of accomplishment, but ultimately wishing that they could have been more than just a, quote, Band-Aid on an impoverished health system. Just here at Wright State, we have groups that go to Jamaica, Swaziland, Costa Rica, and really a host of other places. And the work that they do when they're down there certainly fills a short-term need. The clinics are always full of patients. They treat lots of people. But they're only in these locations for a short time, usually only a couple of weeks, and then they go home. But these needy, underserved patients are home, and their home doesn't have the medical infrastructure to keep them healthy for the, quote, other 50 weeks of the year. And that's what I think is so exciting about Dr. O'Neill's Village Health Team, or VHT, model. Under his model, volunteers spend their time training local healthcare workers to tend to their own neighbors' needs during those other 50 weeks of the year. They basically set up instant medical infrastructure, you know, thus taking steps to improve the baseline health of the entire community, okay, raising that level of health from the bottom up. And they're not just putting on Band-Aids. What they're doing is they're really teaching people to make their own Band-Aids and to know when and more importantly, how to use them. Many medical service trips like the one students participate in here at Wright State are annual trips. But with Dr. O'Neill and OmniMed's model, the thing is, the trips don't need to be annual.
I think Dr. O'Neill's focus on building on this existing infrastructure in these countries is really unique, and it's a very new model for medical volunteerism. I think it also focuses very importantly on the role of physician as educator and kind of gives the medical student the opportunity to be part of that education. But, you know, this basic public health education that they do, like Dr. Anil said, hand washing, the use of mosquito nets, the construction of latrines, while also treating these village health teams to treat the common diseases like malaria, dehydration, things that we probably take for granted in the United States, is very important in teaching these people how to care for themselves and how to really raise the bar of public health in these very, very impoverished places. Through education, he is also multiplying the impact of the time spent on the ground by the Omnimed volunteers beyond the month spent overseas, by having them focus on training rather than treating, and having them continue to follow up and maintain and educate these valuable people in their community.
And probably one of the biggest questions our listeners have right now is, does this really work? And Dr. O'Neill spent a lot of time in the interview talking about the formal studies that they're doing into the changes in overall health outcomes in each community, the changes in health behaviors, as he called it, in which the VHTs have worked. Now, anecdotally or through stories, he's seen that it works. He's been there. He knows that it works. But now he's trying to prove it empirically. As he said in the interview, if he can prove that it works, then more people will buy in, literally, and support his cause.
So how do future Ed O'Neills, you know, get there? How can we as physicians in training break out of the mold and pursue our passions in uniquely impactful ways? Well, it's not going to be easy. Between getting through the rigors of medical school and then spending years paying it off, it's hard sometimes to think outside the box regarding where our medical careers can take us. But Dr. O'Neill is proof positive that you can be a great doctor and family man and make a global impact. It all starts with an awareness of the needs in the medical community, and then study the root causes of those needs and work to address those root causes. Of course, you can always just hop online and email Dr. O'Neill to pick his brain as well. You can also pick up his book, Awakening Hippocrates, at bookstores nationwide or on his website. We have a lot to look forward to the rest of this season, including a unique interview with a neurosurgeon discussing why and how he prays with his patients, airing an exciting series on patient safety and quality improvement featuring the most recent director of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Don Berwick. All that, as well as many more stories from educators, physicians, and patients alike, on Season 7 of Radio Rounds. Start the countdown to our 100th episode.
Tune in every Sunday at noon Eastern Time on WWSU 106.9 FM and Sundays at midnight Eastern Time on WYSO 91.3. And of course, you can download our podcast on demand of all past episodes on our website, radiorounds.org. These podcasts are also available as downloads on iTunes. Just search the iTunes store for Radio Rounds.
You can also contact our team at Radio Rounds via email, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. All that information and much more at RadioRounds.org.
Production made possible in part by MedPlus Advantage, sponsored by the American Medical Association, providing group disability and life insurance to students and residents through participating educational institutions. Visit us at MedPlusAdvantage.com.
Radio Rounds is also proudly partnered with the Student Doctor Network online at studentdoctor.net. Find answers to your questions about medical school or residency programs. Ask questions in our online forums and get answers quickly. It's fast, easy, and available now at studentdoctor.net.
Thanks as well to our entire hardworking staff here at Radio Rounds and to all of you out there listening.
Please remember that the views and opinions expressed on Radio Rounds are not representative of the views and opinions of the partners of Radio Rounds or of the Wright State University Boonshoff School of Medicine. Have a great week, everybody. For our entire staff here at Radio Rounds, I'm John Corker.
And I'm Ryan Shapiro. And one day,
we'll be your doctors.
Here come the Radio Rounds. Welcome to Radio Rounds.